today we have a fascinating panel on the latest European Union elections. It was an exciting time over in Europe on Sunday, watching the results. We've got three experts in the field. First of all, we've got Geoffrey Harris. He's currently the deputy head of the European Parliament Liaison Office with the United States Congress, and he was formerly the head of the Human Rights Unit within the Secretariat General of the European Parliament. We've got Paul Adamson. He's the editor-in-chief and founding publisher of eSharp, an online magazine on Europe and Europe's place in the world. He's also a senior European partner advisor at Covington and Burling. He's also on the advisory group of British Influence, which is a new organisation promoting the UK's role in the European Union. And we've got Philippe Maisonceur. He's the executive director of ABCOR Worldwide, Washington DC's office, and he leads ABCOR's government relations practice. He brings nearly 20 years of experience working with governments and governmental structures in Europe, Africa, India, and North America. And first of all, we'll start with Geoffrey, who'll explain what's going on and what are the implications in the European Parliament.
Well, good morning. Thank you for coming. Let's start off by saying it wasn't meant to be like this the morning after the, I think, the 7th or the 8th European Parliament elections. I vividly remember the first in 1979, and it was a period of difficulty in terms of Britain's relations with Europe, so nothing has changed, and there was also right away the problem of mobilizing voters for a European election about which the voters seemed unaware of the consequences. In the intervening decades, the European Parliament has gained enormous powers. Great interest in how the Parliament is going to function in this difficult situation, precisely because under various treaties, the Parliament has gained many powers. On the margins, some people say there's a kind of power grab, the Parliament exaggerates its role sometimes. That may or may not be the case. Obviously, I couldn't comment on that. But the treaties that exist, from the Single European Act to the Lisbon Treaty, may have been called for by the European Parliament, maybe in different procedures, but they weren't decided by the European Parliament. They were negotiated by the member states in an intergovernmental conference, ratified by all the national parliaments, and then it's up to the institutions to implement their provisions. So it was worth remembering that, although whilst the European Parliament naturally, when it arrived in 1979 and realized that even its power to reject the budget, the sole power it had at that time, amounted to nothing, turned its attention to how to develop a European Union. Initially, this idea was dismissed as a Spinellian fantasy, Spinelli being kind of drug as well. I think it's like a joint. So Altiero Spinelli was high on marijuana from the 1940s onwards, but he produced a draft treaty on European Union, considered a little bit avant-gardist, but now virtually everything in the draft treaty of 1984 is the law of the European land, covering the 28 member states, and moreover the euro, which is perhaps the most problematic development of the last 30 years, was not an idea which initiated its birth and development in the European Parliament or in the Spinelli Treaty, as it happens. But these are small historical reflections because I haven't reached the age where I forget everything, at least quite not yet. So it wasn't meant to be like this, and political science terms, you've got a whole lot of unintended consequences. Early on, it became clear that the European elections would provide a platform to anti-European political parties. It's 30 years since Le Pen Pair, as they call him in France. Jean-Marie Le Pen broke through in the 1984, the second European Parliament elections, had a huge impact, led to, in fact, many positive developments in terms of developing the European Union's anti-racist legislation. The crisis with regard to the euro has been there since the beginning. We overlooked the fact that the people of France almost by a whisker almost rejected the very treaty which President Mitterrand had insisted upon as part of the whole post-Cold War political settlement, namely to have a euro. Chancellor Kohl, for obvious reasons, wasn't mad keen. Maggie Thatcher was dead against, but France and Germany being the motor of integration, the euro was born, and let's face it, it has had a number of unintended consequences. Whether they were entirely unexpected, of course, depends on where you're sitting. And to speed up on this stage of my presentation, the 2014 European elections took place against a backdrop of, at best, uncertainty as to the economic prospects of many European countries, and indeed quite substantial economic and social pain in some of the countries, and therefore the results from that point of view shouldn't be surprising. So before we write off the whole exercise and say, well, how isn't it all sad, or all the rest of it, why are you all here this morning? I mean, it's true that the media, there's not a great deal of coverage of the election outcome, and it's concentrating on the headline issue of the populist extreme right breakthrough. I think it is because in the United States there is an awareness that anything important with regard to trade, with regard to data privacy, with regard to economic policy, perhaps to a lesser extent, has to have the agreement of the European Parliament to come into effect. So the debate, which is now beginning about the program of the Commission for the next 5 years, will be of great international importance. And as I said to Paul, I prefer to talk about that more than about the camembert. So we've distributed you this, the simple explanation or the simple detail which is being repeated, shall we say, in Brussels, is that two-thirds of the members of the European Parliament are in favor of continuing the European integration process and would have no truck with destroying the European Union. That is objective political fact. However, when it comes to policy issues, TTIP, economic policy, austerity versus looser monetary policy, et cetera, et cetera, there are a very wide range of opinions even within the largest groups. And you've even got, within the EPP, you've got a couple of leaders, most notably Mr. Orban from Hungary, who don't want Mr. Juncker, who was the EPP candidate for president. And among the socialists, you've got 20-odd members from the British Labour Party who pointedly refused to endorse Mr. Schulz as the next president of the European Commission. So there's no overwhelming winner. I obviously would draw your attention to the fact that the European Parliament is somewhat more complicated, you might even say more sophisticated body than the Congress of the United States, where I haven't come across more than two parties, but if there are some others, please introduce me. A lot of the arguments, of course, there also go on inside parties. It's perfectly logical. The camembert also suggests that there is no overwhelming winner. The lead candidate of the EPP, sitting on his 28% of the vote, says, well, I won because I got more than everybody else. But, of course, in a parliamentary system, whoever is to take over a leading position has to have a majority. And in this case, now I'll explain very, very briefly where we are. The majority has to first be built up in a body which is the most powerful body in the European Union, but it's not necessarily noticed as such by all observers, namely the European Council. Mr. Herbert Van Rompuy, appointed alongside Baroness Ashton 5 years ago. These were the two major novelties of the Lisbon Treaty, the strengthening of the European Council and the establishment of a High Representative for Foreign Affairs, who is also the Vice President of the Commission. And I'm not saying one, it's all intergovernmental and the federal institutions don't matter, far from it. But the fact is that to get this particular ball rolling, Mr. Van Rompuy has to create a majority among the 28 member states in favor of a nominee to be presented to the European Parliament in the first session after it's constituted, that's in the first week of July, and then to be voted on a few weeks later. So the Parliament elects the President of the Commission, that's in the treaty, but the European Council nominates. And it, if I may say, simplify brutally, the European Union, in my opinion, is based on two pillars of legitimacy. The European Parliament is the only directly elected supranational institution. That's its place in history. For better or worse, it is there on that basis. However, the members of the European Council representing the governments are also elected to their positions. So collectively, at a second stage, they also represent collectively the legitimacy drawn from national elections. And so long as they can agree, whether it's on the nomination of a commission president or whether it's on a law on data processing or on a treaty with the United States, then the European Union can move forward. And so I would say, in spite of the election results, rise of populism, and obviously I can discuss that a bit, there's no reason to believe that the basic system is under threat from these election results, and that we could discuss. The Parliament will come into force, come in to set itself up in a few weeks' time at a critical time in international relations, and that's what you're primarily interested in. Ukraine is a kind of emblematic issue in terms of the challenges not only to Europe but also to NATO in terms of values and in terms of national security, if you like, and it is clear that after the Commission comes into office, there will have to be a very substantial review of the European neighbourhood policy, as it's called, because what President Prodi described, hopefully 10 years ago, as a ring of friends, has now turned into a ring of fire. And that is extremely dangerous in terms of mass migration, war, civil war, right on the doorstep of the European Union. Some people in the United States tend to think that the enlargement process, which I'm participating in myself, I'm very proud of it, but sometimes tend to see that as the solution to all problems. Okay, let Ukraine join the European Union. I even heard somebody a few months ago, couldn't you just sort of lower the criteria a bit so that Bosnia-Herzegovina, an even more failing state than Ukraine, should join the European Union quicker than expected, i.e. in 25 or 30 years' time. So I consider that is going to be one of the major tests, obviously in the short term, how to handle Ukraine, but in the long term, how the European Union rethinks its relations with its neighbours. There are so-called elections going on in Egypt. Even most of the Egyptians seem to be unconvinced that it's worth bothering to vote for reasons which we can understand. So hopefully the US will not just criticize on the sidelines. We've heard via the airwaves expressions of frustration with the slow processes of the European Union, but a quick rush towards EU enlargement not only wouldn't be accepted by the citizens of the European Union, it wouldn't work. So very briefly, there is also, having been the head of the Human Rights Unit and established excellent cooperation with NGOs and the State Department here in Washington, we see in these elections a challenge to European values. And the question is whether Europeans still do believe in European values. This is in the treaties as one of the main elements of the European Union's external relations. We have problem situations inside the European Union, the Hungary situation. We have a rising anti-immigration movement. And so the whole question of soft power Europe, which seemed to be very strong a few years ago, is also up for review because it's severely challenged. Into this story comes the NSA stroke TTIP situation. Unfortunately, again, being very, very brief, the NSA revelations did have a big impact on public opinion in European countries. The European Parliament looked into the things in a very objective way, had excellent cooperation from the Congress and the administration, and came to the conclusion that there were certain problems that need to be solved with regard to illegal surveillance of EU citizens, and more or less hinted that unless they were solved, it would be very, very difficult to get a majority in the European Parliament for the TTIP. So that's where we are with that. We can talk about it. But since the TTIP has been presented as very much a geopolitical project, a reassertion of US-EU cooperation, it would clearly be a pity if the project failed to get off the ground. And slowness of negotiations is therefore a bit disturbing. Another thing to watch out for, of course, is all the attention is on the Commission President, but of course the institutions will have to nominate the successor to Baroness Ashton, who, whatever policy positions, or, has done a solid job of establishing a European External Action Service. There is a basis there. Whether the European Union is now ready to give the job to a stronger, more outspoken figure who would take a leadership position. Suggesting that Baroness Ashton hasn't done that, but she's gauged her power, I think, in a correct way. That choice is also going to be an important indicator, and hopefully somebody will be chosen who has as good relations with the United States as Baroness Ashton has built up. So finally, in the words of Johnny Cash, let's be frank about the situation. It isn't that good. But whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. It's a challenge. I know that's a platitude, but I mean, it's a challenge. And either the European Union leaders do believe in the process of European integration, or they're all going to run away from it. I don't see much running away taking place, mainly because the running away isn't a very attractive prospect. Indeed, quite frankly, I don't think even the British people are going to run away from this if the terms of the referendum, which might take place in 3 or 4 years' time, are put. There are no long-term set of opinion polls suggesting that the British people have a settled view. They want to be out of this. They're not happy with it. But then all across Europe, people aren't happy with the European Union. Finally, just one final point, because I've abused, Clinton, Steinmeier both make the same point, one about NATO, one about the European Union. We are in a period of generational change. Doesn't mean that people over 60 should be put out to grass, I hope. Maybe it's a good idea. But people over 60 just have to remember that people in their 20s and 30s not only have different ways of communicating and this sort of thing, they look at the situation differently. Of course, the Holocaust and the Second World War were a part of the foundation of the European integration process. If you don't know that, you lose a sense of perspective. However, in an age of mass unemployment in Spain, huge economic difficulties in Italy and other countries, Greece in particular, it's hardly surprising that the sort of general idea of Europe is challenged by those who say, well, it's a nice idea, but where's my job, and how come things are so good in Germany and they're not so good here? So no reason to rest on the laurels of the broadly successful European integration period so far, but it's going to be a difficult period.
Thank you. Paul.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you for organizing this event and your staff. Many of my comments would be rather critical, maybe, but in a constructive spirit, I hope. I want to make clear that I'm a big fan of the European Parliament, have been for a very long time. My first job as an unpaid intern was working for the agency in the UK promoting the first elections to the European Parliament. My first paid job, just about paid, was working as a parliamentary assistant. Obviously, it was child labour at the time, probably illegal, but that's my sort of history of the European Parliament. So my comments now are offered in a maybe constructive spirit. I happened to read two op-eds this morning before coming here. One was titled Business as Usual, and the second one was entitled Business as Usual is Not an Option. And that's maybe kind of the confusion now that's currently reigning. We're not sure what to make of the elections and their immediate aftermath. I don't want to go too much about the paradox of the Parliament's powers and the relative lack of sort of interest people have in the European Parliament. But as we all know, the Lisbon Treaty, this is the first elections taking place since the Lisbon Treaty came into effect. The Lisbon Treaty gave the Parliament even more powers and new competencies, co-legislated with the Council, new powers over the budget, powers to ratify trade treaties, etc., etc. So it's even more powerful than ever before. And these are the first elections to take place under that new regime. Despite that, turnout wasn't very good. Despite also the increased budget spent on promoting the election, the turnout wasn't very good. And despite the Spitz and Kandidat and the televised debates and hustings taking place around the Spitz and Kandidat, and turnout was not very good. So I think the Parliament has to reflect a bit on its own position in that context. They are victims, like everybody else, if you like, of the general malaise with the European project, the lack of trust in politicians generally. They're just maybe one example of that as well. They're not immune to that situation. They have to be cognizant of it. The Parliament tends to think of itself as kind of sui generis and not bound by the same kind of ways of analyzing other assemblies and other politicians, but I think they have to take stock. If I'm looking for some silver lining, and I am by nature an optimist, is that at least for the, hopefully in the short term, if not the medium to long term, Europe's leaders will have to think seriously, not just about the aftermath of the election, but also the European project and the new organization of the EU, the European Commission, coming up in the next few months. And hopefully we'll have some sustained focus by European leaders on what Europe is all about, never mind the European Parliament. We'll see that. Certainly inside the European Parliament, we all know a bit about the media, there'll be a lot of media attention on the European Parliament. It is true, we all know that this 25% aggregate groups on the left and the right who are sort of anti-establishment or anti-EU or whatever are quite sort of disorganized many ways and certainly don't sort of club together in any kind of coherent groupings normally. But they're very noisy and they are very good at getting people's attention. So that also will encourage the media to show an interest, certainly the first few weeks and months until they lose interest or some other crisis comes along into what the European Parliament is up to, which in turn, I think the dynamic that will be created where there'll be a kind of competition between, you know, the cheerleaders of Europe, if you like, and our political masters on the one hand, and these anti-establishment groups to collectively raise their game and be more coherent and focused, as I said, on what Europe should be about in the 21st century. Since Sunday, there's a conventional wisdom, and it borders on complacency, in my view, which is why I think it's rather worrying, that don't worry, chaps, too much, because there's a core group comprising the European People's Party, centre-right, socialist group, centre-left, and the Liberals, where they are the kind of solid core and they command a sufficient majority to get things through the European Parliament. So that's fine, isn't it? Well, I'm not sure if that is fine. I mean, one of the concerns I had in the Sunday evening listening to some of the Spitzenkandidaten was they were saying, while sort of rubbing their wounds, they were saying also, well, one of the conclusions is that we need to have more Europe. I don't doubt for a second their sincerity. For the sake of argument, I don't even doubt their analysis. Maybe the solution to some of these issues, concerns, is more Europe, but that's not what people in the street are thinking. So I think it's really, really important that people expressing those kind of views are more cognizant of that. I did a bit of research, and Jeff and I know very well, maybe others in the room know very well, a guy called Julian Priestley, who was for 15 years, a long time, Secretary General of the European Parliament. He wrote a book 7 years ago called Six Battles That Shaped Europe's Parliament, in a very prescient way, and rather ironic given that he was a mastermind of Martin Schulz's campaign. He says the following, and it's, bear with me while I quote it verbatim. In the unlikely event of any potential voter reading the manifestos of the PPE, the European People's Party, the Socialists or the Liberals, they would find large parts completely interchangeable. This is the downside of the cross-party collaboration which has been so necessary to take the Union forward and to enhance the role and influence of the Parliament. This stifling consensus is now suffocating political vitality and impeding any connection between the European politicians and the European citizens. The logic of the Lisbon Treaty, this was written before the treaty came into force, would be to factor into the election campaign the potential candidates for the presidency of the Commission. But the truth is that electors are some distance from being at the point where such a choice might be meaningful. There's a risk that it would be seen as an artificial gimmick which would backfire. And I think that's the danger for the Parliament now. They are obviously insisting, and rightly so in many ways, because they've gone so far now, like a poker game, vis-a-vis the European Council, as Jeff was referring to put forward their candidate now, the single one, Jean-Claude Juncker, to be the president of the Commission. But, you know, there's this tug of war now between the two institutions. And I think what's going to happen, quite possibly, is that a candidate who was not one of the Spitzenkandidaten is nominated, as Jeff said, by the heads of state and government around the council table, European Council table, and then may at some point go through, get the vote and the absolute majority in the European Parliament required. It might need more than one kind of kamikaze suicide pact prime minister or head of international organization to go through that process, but we'll get there in the end, maybe, at which point citizens, voters are entitled to say, well, why did you make us watch those rather dreary but solemn debates on television telling us we were kind of helping to vote out the next president of the European Commission? You've gone again and chosen somebody behind closed doors, even if paradoxically, and let's be quite clear, one of those candidates chosen behind closed doors you know, or either sitting prime minister or head of an international organization, would be a better candidate, arguably, than Jean-Claude Juncker or even Martin Schulz. So I think we've created this kind of lose-lose situation, which is not beneficial to anybody who's remotely pro-European. So I think my only sort of conclusion to all that, so I'm quite brief conclusion, is that, yes, if the solution is more Europe, then people who make that case have to make a much better case for more Europe. I think we're all on the same page now that Europe has to be reformed, but I think it's high time that our political leaders gave more clarity and definition to what a reformed Europe should be and should look like. Thank you.
Thank you. Philippe.
Well, I'll try and not to keep you waiting too long so we can move on to Q&As. Paul, if you'll allow me, before I start, I'd like to actually react to what has been said. Jeffrey, you mentioned that it wasn't meant to be like this. Well, actually, I'm not so sure. For once, I think pollsters and pundits, for once, got it right. I mean, we've known what was coming for quite a while, and I'm just amazed at the headlines we've been seeing for the last two or three days, sort of media circus, because this has been in the making for a long time. And actually, to both your points, you know, business as usual, two-thirds of the members are in favor of the union. I think we are here running a huge risk. We have been, on purpose, sort of, you know, the Euro fan crowd, poo-pooing, putting down, playing down results which, you know, you were talking about the Maastricht Treaty back in the 90s, you know, the French and Dutch referendum in 2005. Do you know, in a place that claims to be a democracy, you know, an organization that makes a sovereign country re-vote because it doesn't like the results that our Irish friends came up with, you know, 6 or 7 years ago? Oh, sorry, we don't like what your people told us, so please re-vote until we get the result we want. And I think this business of business as usual is really dangerous and could create an even bigger backlash than what we've just seen on Sunday. So, to go on quickly, I just looked at what your title was today, Implications for the United States, and I'd like to leave you with three takeaways on two points. One, how the current elections will actually impact the way Brussels functions, and two, very quickly, what are the implications for the US, and perhaps then open it to the floor. Regarding Brussels, I think actually this is a message that cannot and that will not be ignored. But funnily enough, now that I've just said that, and to your point, Paul, I think that it is probably going to be business as usual in the parliament, which is frightening. Business as usual because the three mainstream parties still hold, indeed, as you were saying, a pretty sizable majority. Because while the Eurosceptic in France, in the UK, in Denmark, Austria, Greece, Sweden, Hungary, I mean, pretty much across the board, actually, will be holding a sizable number of seats, somewhere just shy of what, 100, is it just shy of 100 in the new parliament. There is very little that unites them besides their dislike of the union. And without getting into the nitty-gritties of how the parliament works, creating a group, being able to build alliances and push an agenda forward is going to be, I think, probably pretty difficult. It will certainly create hurdles and hassles in terms of, you know, some of the committees and the commissions and who's going to be doing what and who will be able to push or hinder an issue. But overall, I'm willing to bet that it is going to be pretty much business as usual and it's not going to have a huge impact on the way the parliament works. I think where we are going to be seeing a much bigger impact, and I haven't seen much written about this, but maybe I haven't read enough, is actually at council level. I think that what has happened in a number of countries at national level is going to have a huge impact in the ways that governments are going to be behaving in Brussels. And I think that the room for maneuver for a François Hollande or a David Cameron, or actually for a Danish prime minister, is going to be very seriously reduced. And we will most probably see a much more nationalistic or, in any event, a less Brussels, you know, the traditional Brussels compromise. We'll see probably a lot less of this going forward. I also think, you know, we've all been talking about the parliament, but I think something much more important with regard to what Paul was talking about, the European project, or what sort of Europe people want. I think we're facing a real désamour with the goals of an ever closer union. When you have an election when turnout is barely at 43% and actually falling below 30% in many countries, what I found really calling was the fact that in most of the new member states, you know, the results or the turnout was below 30. I mean, in Slovakia, I was in this city about 3 weeks ago at an event of the Slovak embassy, you know, celebrating the 10 years of Slovakia in the union. Well, only 13% of Slovaks could be bothered to go out on Sunday and vote. It is really telling for these new members, having come out of communism, joining the union that was there. I mean, that was an incredible objective. You were talking about 2004 and having, you know, participated in the enlargement. That was, you know, 1st of May 2004 was an incredible date. Well, it's very interesting to see that 10 years later, almost to the day, only 13% of the Slovaks and, you know, very little more of the Hungarians, the Czechs and the Bulgarians and the Romanians and so on and so forth could be bothered to turn out and vote. As Marcellus said in Hamlet a while back, you know, something is rotten in the state of Denmark. Well, I don't know if it's the state of Denmark, but in the European Union, there's no doubt. So these are my three takeaways for Europe. I would just add a small codicil. I think it will be very interesting to see what does indeed happen, how the treaties are read in terms of how the president of the next commission is going to be chosen, whether it will be indeed a representative of the strongest party in parliament, or whether, again, we'll see some, you know, closed-door discussion and a new candidate pulled out of the hat. From a U.S. perspective, and very quickly, I think, you know, Secretary of State Kissinger's question is, what number do I dial for Europe, is still very much on the table and no closer to being answered. More than happy to be challenged on this, but I believe that Brussels is actually going to be even more marginalized at the expense of some of the key member states in the next 5 years. Germany, first and foremost, quite obviously. France, Poland, most probably in the UK, although between the upcoming general election and the probable EU referendum, that makes things rather complicated for the UK in the very short term. The current US administration has shown actually quite little interest with regards to Brussels. Getting the president over has been an interesting task, I'd say, over the last few years. And I would say that, you know, last Sunday's results are not likely to improve or to change things much on that front. Is TTIP in trouble? Well, was it Marine Le Pen this morning or yesterday who just called for a halt or, you know, a slowing down on TTIP? I think that we're going to see a much more polarized parliament, and to Paul's point, maybe that's good to have, you know, a more political parliament. We're certainly going to see a parliament with a much stronger anti-capitalist, anti-corporate, anti-globalization agenda, actually on both the right and the left, or the far right and the far left, as you wish. The NSA scandal was mentioned, and having been in the city for a while, it's pretty incredible to see the difference of perception of how important that issue is on both sides of the Atlantic, and the, speaking as a European here, the lack of understanding from the US side as to the effect it has had in a number of countries. That the UK and France were not more puzzled or frazzled by that, yes, I mean, both countries do exactly the same thing. But when you understand Germany a little bit better, when you know or recall that that country has gone from Nazism to communism for part of it, that the current chancellor is the daughter of a religious figure that was stalked by the Stasi during most of his life, the idea that that country's best, closest ally could be listening in to what that leader's saying on the telephone. Well, in the US I hear, come on. I mean, she had to know that we'd be doing that. I think on the, you know, in Germany, people would expect the Russians and the Chinese to do this, but that country's closest ally, perhaps not. And there's a real big disconnect on that. I would like to leave it with the fact that one shouldn't forget that ACTA, the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which, without going into details, was a trade agreement signed, negotiated by the Commission, put forward before Parliament for ratification, actually wasn't signed and was killed because of a people's reaction. And I think we are likely to see a lot more of that, and TTIP is really running the risk of being caught in that that process. To conclude on TTIP, I'll just say one thing. While I've put all those caveats and highlighted that TTIP will be facing certainly stronger, bigger hurdles in Brussels, I actually think that the biggest hurdles for ratification is not Brussels. It's probably going to be the US Congress, if ever we get there, but that's another question. Other event. The last thing, to close on my part, I think it's going to be also a lot more difficult for Washington to find a consensus on big geostrategic issues, whether it's Russia, Ukraine, China, Iran. And again, not so much because of the European Parliament, but I think what has happened during those elections and the shakeup at national level is going to have an impact on how the countries of the European Union are going to be looking at or addressing some of those issues. It is really interesting, and that will be my last point, to see the amount of aura or following that President Putin has or may have with a number of the leaders of those nationalistic parties in Europe. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take Q&A from the audience, but I'm going to, if you put your hand up and tell me where you're from, we'll have a microphone to you. I'm going to ask the first question, though, to the panel, and leading on from your Russia comment. Putin will be in the European Union next month for the D-Day anniversary. What will be the impact of the elections and the impact of the impact on the European Union's relations with Russia? We'll go down the panel, and Jeff, do you want to?
I'm not sure it's a visit to Russia, but I read that Hollande is going to meet Putin. But I mean, that was always
June 16.
But whether there's some other such meeting is an issue of. But I would take the case of Putin and put it back to my conclusion about generational change. History is an important part of politics. Certainly, having worked in the European project, certainly on the inside with people who've been in the resistance on left and right, Otto von Habsburg, Willy Brandt, whatever. That's why I say it wasn't meant to be like this. It did seem a great ideal worth working for at the beginning, and I stick to my point of departure. But currently, the only leader in Europe who's playing the history card and showing an understanding of history from his point of view, from my point of view, is Putin. And Europe, the European Union, as well as having strong leaders, clear policies in difficult circumstances, has to have an alternative narrative as to why we have the European Union, why the idea of respecting frontiers is essential, why interdependence is so much better than armed conflict and destroying your neighbors through intelligence operation. So that is what I see as the significance of Putin. The fact that he's got some friends on the extreme right, again, suggests he's playing in a certain historical vision of nationalism, which still has some credibility in Europe. And so we'll see how the scenario in the Normandy landings, Normandy beaches, is played out by the but the message from him will be, we are part of Europe as a strong nation, and indeed we intend to play our part fully. Our answer should be, of course you play your part fully in terms of interdependence, but in terms of open markets, open society, rule of law, all the rest of it, which was laid down in the Helsinki process some decades ago.
Yes, Putin might be in Normandy on the 6th of June, but he won't be in Brussels the day before for the now renamed G7. He's disinvited. I think we have to be very clear about where we stand with Russia. It's too easy, obviously, to strike poses on Russia. And there are people whose views I respect back in Brussels who say that the EU had a sort of collective folly in strategy in taking the approach it did. They were strong-armed a bit by Lithuania and Poland, maybe. I have no idea if that is a fair assessment or not. An element which is not unimportant, but it's also quite legitimate, I would argue, is the role of large corporations who have important financial interests in Russia, who are suggesting that a certain, slightly more lenient, maybe that's the wrong word, approach should be taken vis-a-vis Putin and some of these sanctions. So that's all playing against the backdrop also, of course, of energy security and the need for us to keep our homes warm, certainly in certain countries. So I think all I would suggest in terms of the European Parliament going forward is it's what we haven't discussed yet. I mean, one of the clear roles I would argue for the Parliament, it doesn't sound particularly powerful or glamorous and doesn't involve regulation and flexing one's treaty muscles, but just as a great convener, as a great place to have civilized adult discussions between consenting partners, as it were. And I think that's one contribution that Parliament can make in its new manifestation is to be the host for some serious discussions about EU's future relations with Russia.
Yeah, very briefly, I think just 2 points. I think seen from the US is a weak reaction from Europe on that front. I think the importance of Russia as a partner, both in terms of business and energy, whatever, but also as a strategic partner in the region, is very different seen from Europe as it is seen from the US. If I'm not mistaken, and don't quote me on this, but I read somewhere, if I remember correctly, that the US was only the 28th economic partner to Russia. So taking sanctions is a bit different when it doesn't affect you than when it does. I think the second thing that would be is worthwhile watching regarding the Ukraine-Russia situation is the actual split that it has created within the European Union. Another one, and something which is not helping the current disenchantment mood in Europe. But you're seeing this sort of arc going from Sweden, which has taken a really belligerent position on that issue, to obviously a number of the former Soviet states or Warsaw Pact countries. On the one hand, wanting a tough, robust response, and a much weaker reaction from UK, Germany, France. And this is also creating another split, or bring another wedge between a number of the EU member states.
Hi, Julia Piper. I'm with Environment Energy Publishing News Service. I wonder if we could get into the energy issue a little bit more. I think there was the energy security meeting the last 2 days. I haven't read the outcome yet, but the Commission came out with something. I wonder how the Parliament would affect the energy security discussion. That's on the one hand, specifically, also how this relates to the U.S. and natural gas exports. Separately, on climate policy, if you have any thoughts on that, do you think the EU will remain a unified group pushing forward in the IPCC negotiations or not?
Should we go backwards this time?
These are two good and two tough questions. Parliament and energy. I think, going back to the point I just made, you will see probably less of an ideological and more of a national split. Again, on this, our Baltic and Polish friends, for instance, are very keen to do everything in their power to provide alternatives to the dependency they have today on Russian oil and gas. So I think that's going to be certainly one driver. As to your second question, I think I will defer to my co-panelists here to give you a better, more in-depth answer.
Well, a very brief answer. I'm not an expert in your input, but you clearly are. One is that then going to back to my earlier point, Parliament is a kind of convening power, not just a co-legislator, as it were, and that depends much on yesterday's agreed energy security package. They want to be really useful. They could have these discussions, serious discussions about what we're trying to achieve in Europe on the back of this crisis, point one. Very briefly. And point two on climate, I think it's linked with that being too pedantic, and when we get slightly off, as Paul would say, a subject for another round table, is the future organization of the Commission, where there's talking about trying to have these sort of so-called clusters of policies around reporting lines to a senior vice president, and that'll actually make things, in principle, more coherent. We might have, you know, an environment, energy, a transport cluster reporting to another commissioner, and that would have an impact also, therefore, on how the Parliament deals with that new configuration as well.
Yeah, briefly, I mean, one of the fascinations of being here, observing the domestic debate as compared with the debate going on in Europe, is, of course, the debate on climate change, where I think in Wyoming or something, it wasn't possible even to include the issue in school syllabuses. But, you know, it's a deep cultural difference, you know, the references made to NSA and this type of thing. I don't say Europe has got the answer to climate change and carbon emissions, all these issues, all the obvious internal contradictions exist. However, in Europe, few people would challenge the need for the European Union as part of a global effort to have an active policy with regard to dealing with the consequences of climate change and doing that in a global level. But the prospects for that are not very good. One, because China is not very interested, and one is that the American administration is very interested but hasn't got sufficient support to really do the job. So the president himself is reduced to sort of trying to go round Congress and make some, broadly speaking, symbolic issues. On the issue of energy security, I mean, the world doesn't begin on the 1st of July. The issue of energy security has been debated frequently in the European Parliament. It's true that perhaps the impulse came from Polish politicians like former Prime Minister Buzek or the former Foreign Minister Cyrus Wolski, people like this who have been pushing the idea of an energy security union for some time. And I would imagine that would be part of the program of the next commission, given what Tusk and others have been saying, and therefore the place will be one of the places where Parliament will not only debate it, but where all the interest groups, civil society, environmentalists, as well as the companies, can play their part. It is true that there is obviously, and Putin was aware of this from the start, the difference of interest between certain countries in relation to sanctions against Russia, but I don't know, that's for historians. It's not absolutely inconceivable, however, that the threat of further sanctions if Russian Federation disrupted the elections, which were not disrupted in the end, except locally, had some effect on the comportement, as it were, of President Putin. I'd say it's too early to say. I'd be naive to say it's all fine. He's got the message, but the threat of sanctions, even Mrs. Merkel, an easy meeting with Obama, one could see from the outside, but they did line up on this, and even Britain had been very strong on the consequences of the invasion of Crimea. So it is a work in progress, and that's why I started off with Ukraine in terms of the external relations issues. The situation is very much on a knife edge, but the threat of further sanctions has had an effect, as the threat of real sanctions had had an effect on Iran.
And actually, we will be having more work in a panel on that, on those topics in the future. Just over there.
John Isaacs, Council for Global World, and a strong, long-time backer of European unity. The first speaker, Mr. Harris, said, and I may have not have this quote exactly correct, there's no reason to expect the European Union to be under threat. And I'm wondering if the other two speakers agree that there's not a serious threat to the European Union now in light of the troubles with the euro, in light of the economic problems in a lot of the countries, and the elections over the weekend.
Paul, do you want
to? Oh, okay. Yeah, well, we haven't really discussed much this morning so far. It's true, is the impact maybe of these some so-called extreme anti-establishment groups on domestic politics, right, rather than as opposed to their role or their behavior inside the European Parliament. And it's true, I think that is where is a danger point maybe, in that governments and political, mainstream political parties, even in opposition, have to work out, they try and play to that, you know, and that's trying to, you know, absorb or imitate and mimic some of the policies, if you like, of these parties, or on the contrary, not. And you heard maybe Tony Blair a couple of days ago saying it'd be a mistake for Miliband, the Labour Party leader in Britain, to try to make too many, you know, statements about immigration, et cetera, et cetera, that there lies folly. And it is true, on the back, as you're suggesting, so maybe in your question, the Eurozone crisis, you know, it's been handled in a certain way which leaves a lot to be desired. And ordinary people are, yes, just fed up, and they obviously express some of that frustration at the European Parliament elections on Sunday if they bothered to turn out at all. I think that this is, you know, it's easy to be a bit dramatic, but forgive me. I think we are at a kind of existential moment in the European project, and the election is just the latest stage in that manifestation. And as Philippe suggested in his opening remarks, we can see it coming as well. It's not none of us should be surprised what happened on Sunday. It's just like the latest chapter in a long unfolding saga. So I think yes, I think there is a concern now, and I think my point in my opening remarks also about, you know, business as usual, and will it be a bit cozy and too reassuring to have these core groups saying, well, let's do more pushing forward. I think it's important that the and I don't doubt for a second these people's sincerity, the arch federalists who have very strong views, very sincere views about what Europe should be doing and what member states should not be doing, find more common ground with the other kind of pro-Europeans who see that integration should be revisited and the EU itself should certainly be reformed. And those two groups should certainly have more of a dialogue than hitherto has been the case.
Yeah, I think I'll just not quote, but you know, pluck from Mark Twain, I think that the death of the euro has been somewhat overstated. You know, we've been hearing for years that the euro was dead, still around. Well, Paul's right, there's been a lot of issues around it. It has proved a lot more resilient than many people expected. To your point, I think the idea of an ever closer union is clearly being challenged today. And I'm probably, that's a very personal view. I'm actually probably pretty pessimistic for two reasons. I think it goes further than just the European Union. There's a real angst right now in Europe, a pessimism as to, you know, that continent's place in the world and what you know, what's happening and how the world is moving and how quickly or not Europe can adapt to it. I also think that when you have founding members such as the Netherlands or France that have the reaction they've been having over the last, you know, 10 years, it really raises a question as to the very goals and vision of a European project. And that, to Paul's point, certainly has not been taken into consideration so far and has not been addressed, talked about, debated.
Can I just clarify? When I said right at the beginning, it wasn't meant to be like this. It was not to say we didn't see coming what has happened. I mean, it was this the catastrophe annoncée of Le Monde. I mean, if this was the actual election result on Sunday, was by no means surprising. Some different quirks, you know, maybe take by surprise. But when I said it wasn't meant to be like this, it was that the idea of having an elected European Parliament was precisely intended to legitimize the European Union, and the unintended consequence has been that whilst the powers of the institutions have developed, this legitimacy issue remains as dramatically posed as ever. And so I hope I didn't say the EU is not under threat. Everybody is always under threat. All I'm saying, and that again is also based on historic observation in my own country, there was a party, the Labour Party. It decided it wanted to campaign and get Britain out of Europe. It got nowhere. Mr. Cameron knows that perfectly well, that it's a dead end for his party to go too far in the anti-European direction, and he's looking for a way out of that. In the case of France, it is true that Marine Le Pen is on 25%, and even she's not been explicitly saying France should leave the EU, but she might at some point, if she thinks it's a good idea, call for a referendum. I just do not, I mean, this may be utter complacency, come back in 10 years and we'll see. I don't think people of France will take that seriously for one second. They may find the institutions deeply unpopular, but to go in a popular vote in the privacy of a polling station and vote France out of the European Union, I don't see it. And so that's why I say whatever makes, you know, the challenge is not necessarily lethal, although I totally agree, complacency, business as usual, is off the agenda.
And we've got time for one last question.
Harry Blaney from the Center for International Policy. I'd like to turn this around a little bit and go back to the strategic relationship between and the impact of recent events on the the U.S. and European relationship sides of things. And I want to turn this even around in a different way and ask the question of the panel. First of all, I don't agree with the idea that Obama has been ignoring Europe. I think the problem is Europe has been ignoring the strategic issues and the problems they're facing, and that has turned maybe Obama and his advisors wondering whether Europe can kind of get its act together, particularly after what we see in Ukraine and at all. But getting back to the larger issue of that, I'd like to have the panel tell us two things. One, from the what America should do to strengthen the relationship and to solve, and most importantly, solve the most salient strategic issues that we're facing, which is, of course, relationships, Ukraine, the question of Russia's future and the relationship, the trade pact at all, climate, you've got it. In other words, what in this relationship would you think America should do? Second, since I have some European-oriented people here, what do you think that Europe is not doing and that it ought to be doing now to strengthen that relationship, to solve those same global and regional issues that are facing all of both sides of the Atlantic? Thank you.
Thank you. I'll have to be quick on this one, but I'll start with Jeff.
Well, what should Europe do? I think Europe, first of all, has to regain its self-belief. Because the values which the European Union represents in terms of peaceful cooperation, interdependence, human rights, rule of law, as wide as possible, these are basically acquis inside the European Union, although they are threats to that, but as wide as possible in the neighborhood. Europe has to not only recover its confidence, but also develop a maybe clearer strategic approach to such countries as Ukraine, Egypt, and the rest, where we're not just floundering between, you know, pretending to talk about human rights, but actually not doing anything about it. And that will require a rethink of the whole strategy. And one of the architects of the policy was here a couple of weeks ago, and he admitted himself that it hasn't worked out as planned. And there, the United States should encourage Europe to rethink this, but not, if I may say so, to come out with these what are easy bits of advice. Let Turkey in. Why are you keeping Turkey waiting? You know, change the criteria for Bosnia. Why weren't you clear enough with the Ukraine about joining the European Union? There is European Union enlargement process. One of the successes of that process, in spite of the backlash on immigration, which has been whipped up in one or two parts of the European Union rather effectively, is that the countries have set out on the road to membership and followed through a series of quite drastic economic and political reforms and achieve membership. Ukraine at this moment is not at the first base. Turkey has made a lot of reforms, but they're clearly fundamental issues of rule of law. So the thing that I sometimes say disappoints or irritates me here is, you know, somehow there's some quick solution of further enlargement to stabilize Europe. It's going to be a question of how to make a neighborhood policy much more effective, because when I worked on the enlargement process during the 90s up until 2004, the dog that didn't bark was a public opinion. There was no, at that time, no particular hostility to the idea of European integration. Britain was the subject of a referendum before it joined the common market, but it was a referendum in France because President Pompidou thought he needed a mandate. So I don't think, as part of the business as usual, we should add some idea that over the next decade, beyond the countries of the Western Balkans, which are negotiating accession, a wider enlargement process. That would be my initial reaction.
Thank you, Paul. Very briefly, as you know, so in the first few months or even years of the Obama administration, it was a very popular view in Europe that the US was not taking Europe seriously. And I was always saying that the problem was not that, it was a problem that the EU was not taking the EU seriously. And I'm not sure I agree with Jeff that it's about, you know, lack of confidence. I think it's just, I think we are rather hypocritical in Europe about many things. And I'm not condoning the surveillance stuff for a second, Philippe. on our side of the Atlantic. But I think maybe the US missed an opportunity to put into context why all this event is going on. Because we do, in Europe, let's be clear about it, rely on the US for our security. And I think we just take that rather too much for granted. And I think in discussions about EU, forgive me, gentlemen, I think we have to, and Paul like this, music to his ears, we have to talk more about NATO as well, almost in the same sentence. I'm amused a bit because I hear about TTIP sometimes referred to as an economic NATO. And I've seen people who are defense security specialists saying we need a TTIP for security policy. And I think around, but I'm maybe being slightly facetious, but I think around those kind of discussions, even though they may seem rather technical and maybe business oriented, it's the one good thing about TTIP, being it may go into the sand, as some of my panelists are suggesting, at least it makes the two sides talk. And it reminds actually not just that the two sort of governmental sides, as it were, that they're not just there to defend their sort of national interests, because some of the players are sort of, you know, global players, it reminds us that we're all in this interdependent world. So I think it's a great way to educate everybody. And I think one final comment. I think we've all, on both sides, because at the end of the day, we're all terribly diplomatic and courteous and well brought up and hate calling a spade unless we're really, 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 really desperate. I think now it's time for a frank exchange of views about what we want from each other and how we should do that, build that future together.
A tough question to finish the day on. Very quickly, starting with the second one, Europe is not, you know, what is it not doing? I think to Jeff's point, is about finding its bearing. And to Paul's earlier point about, you know, what is European project? What is it that, you know, Europeans want to rally around? Clearly, there's some questions, you know. Ukraine in Europe, yes, why? Yes, no. Turkey in Europe, you know, yes, why? There's been a loss of goal, objective, and is it the ever-expanding union? Is it a ever-closer union? You know, this is not clear, and people need to understand what it is they're supposed to be supporting, going for, or against. Turning to the security point, I think Europeans are waking up to the fact that soft power is not enough. The problem with that is there are very few countries in Europe, I think there are probably two of them, that have a geostrategic thinking today, and both of them are not doing great, you know, economically or militarily, and their ability to engage is somewhat diminished. If I send you back to a poll that was published last week in Germany, 4/5 of Germans don't want to see any further or any more German troops being sent abroad. That sends a pretty strong signal in terms of, you know, Europe's biggest member state, and sort of kills any idea. Ursula von der Leyen, the German defense minister, had floated an idea in, you know, I think February publicly, that the Germans needed to be more, you know, engaged and more outgoing with, you know, external military operations. Well, you know, 4/5 of the population doesn't want it. I think that's not going to go anywhere in the near future. Turning to your first question, what should the US do? Well, you know what? This is a really tough one, simply because as the big brother in the room, you're expecting the US to be doing two things, which are sort of contradictory in my views, but need to be done if you want to go forward. Number one, there needs to be a lot more listening and taking into serious consideration. I think the NSA issue is an issue, not because of, you know, the Germans, the French, the Brits, we all do that. It's the way it's been handled and the communication around it. Climate change, you know, we were talking about something that, you know, this has been a thorn on both sides, you know, between both partners for quite a while. And there needs to be more accommodation in terms of showing clearer understanding and willingness to call a spade and start talking about things and trying to address them instead of, playing around with them. And there also needs, having said that, very clear leadership, which from my point of view has not necessarily always been the case from, you know, this administration. You know, from Syria to Ukraine to Iran, you know, what's a red line, what's not a red line, what do we really want, and how do we get there together instead of, you know, somehow a floating leadership. So not an easy answer. On the one hand, being perhaps a bit more open to discussion and calling a spade and taking into consideration some of our differences, but also quite clearly for the US to fully embrace and play its role. In terms of setting the tone and being clear about things it wants to achieve.
Thank you so much. This has been an absolute fascinating.
fascinating panel and discussion about events that are happening right now. I just advise you all to check out our website for our next events on stuff of energy and climate, as well as trade and transatlantic relations. But in the meantime, please give the panelists a round of applause.